What I thought I would do, since we've got this organized as chunks of pages, each chunk of which has been read by two or three people, is that I would start with the first chunk and ask the three people who read it what particular cases struck them as interesting that they wanted to talk about or ask about. After that, any case in that chunk that I've got noted down as especially interesting, I will talk about, and I will read a bit of it since the rest of you won't have read that case, and then go on in that method, and we'll see if that procedure works tolerably well. So we start out with Bryce, Christine, and Mark. I don't think I see Christine, but the other two of you are, I think, both here. So for your chunk, which was pages 214 to 239 of the cases, what things struck you as neat and interesting or puzzling? Which would you, can you describe it a little better? Because I've got the book and I can read it to other people. Fallen, right. Yes. And what happens?
Well, ultimately, because he's young, he gets his sentence reduced from execution to life exile.
And is he allowed to commute it or not? You may not have gotten any of them, but there are various cases in which somebody is given what looks a very serious sentence but allowed to commute it for a monetary payment that in most cases is pretty tiny. So it's sort of something close to a get-out-of-jail card for those particular ones. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, he wasn't allowed.
Can you tell me anything else so that I can actually find it? Do you remember what it was? Minute? No. Month?
From 1826, it was like on page... It was the first page of my assignment, so if you scroll down, I can tell you what page it starts on.
Right. Yeah, I'm familiar with it.
So it's on 229 is where it starts.
Right. All right. 229. Yeah, about monetary redemption. Right. Boy of 14 carrying basket loads of earth. Along with a older boy. The older boy, taking advantage of his age, ordered Ting Chi Song to carry the heavier loads and also insulted him by throwing clods of earth at him. Is that the same
one?
That's
the citation.
Ah, I see. That's they're citing a different earlier case, right. So the actual case, Tai Chi, aged 15, had gone with his sickle to the fields to cut grass. On his way, he saw Peng Po Tzu, aged 25, and others harvesting soybeans. Noticing a few beans scattered along the side, Tai Chi collected a handful and put them in his basket. Peng, on seeing this, swore at him and tried to grab his basket. Tai became frightened and ran away, but Peng overtook him and began beating him. Tai wielded his sickle to scare off Peng, but in so doing, he stabbed Peng in the heart, killing him. All right, tragic little story. And the court is sentenced him to strangulation. And there is a petition for clemency. It is pointed out that poor people are customarily permitted to glean scattered wheat or beans left on the ground, that other people were just doing that, and therefore it was unreasonable for the older person to single out the boy. And therefore there are grounds for leniency, and therefore the result is let me see. Yes, life exile, right.
So I guess the title of the section was monetary
redemption, but he doesn't get redemption, that's right. But I think maybe later ones in the section go on to that. Right. Other ones in the initial chunk that... Here, I can put it here. It's also Christine's chunk, I think. Anybody else for the first set of ones that struck them as interesting? All right, the one that I noticed, which I think is in that group, was page 223 to 5, and that's one where you're getting a series of deferrals, and it starts out, the Governor General of Sichuan has petitioned that Liao Xingchou, a criminal whose sentence is that of deferred decapitation, should now be permitted to remain at home to care for his parents. All right, deferred decapitation is decapitation after the assizes. It should be pointed out that the practice of allowing criminals to remain at home for their parents originated as an extra-legal manifestation of kindness designed to provide comfort for the parents during their declining years. It was not intended to be a loophole for escaping punishment. Moreover, in all capital cases involving crimes between relatives belonging to the 5 degrees of mourning, any changing of sentences from immediate execution to execution after the assizes is to be granted in the first place only because of special circumstances calling for compassion. Therefore, the fact that the offender may happen to be the only adult son of aged parents does not at this initial stage suffice him in addition. He had already had his sentence reduced from immediate execution to execution after the assizes, to be permitted to remain at home to care for the parents. If, however, his case should then be placed in the category of those whose circumstances are deserving of capital punishment, this is one of the sorting boxes for the people who are nominally being executed but probably aren't. And if in that form the case should pass through two subsequent autumn assizes without execution of sentence actually taking place, all right, the mechanism is you're sentenced to capital punishment after the assizes. You are then sorted as to how bad a capital punishment you deserve. You then have the emperor make his random choice. You survive the random choice twice and if you're in the right category, and now you go down one and you're now non-capital. So if all of that happens, thereby enabling it thereupon to be transferred to the category of deferred execution, it then finally becomes possible to petition that the criminal be allowed to remain at home to care for his parents. And in the present case, Liao Xingchou got into a fight with another man and fired a musket in order to frighten him. By mistake, however, the shot struck and fatally wounded Liao's father's younger cousin, who accordingly was Liao's own relative of the 4th degree of mourning. They're always doing this, you'll see in the cases, classifying. Liao was therefore sentenced to immediate decapitation. All right, accidental killing, but it's 4th degree of mourning, it's a relative. Under the statute which provides this penalty for a junior relative assaulting and killing a senior relative belonging to the 4th degree of mourning. In accordance with the relevant substatute, this sentence of immediate decapitation was memorialized to the throne, which issued an imperial rescript changing to decapitation after the assizes, and within that category classified it among those cases whose circumstances are deserving of capital punishment. The case having then passed, so he made it, he won his gamble, in this form through two successive autumn assizes without execution of sentences, it was thereupon once more, in accordance with the same substatute, changed in status to deferred execution. At this juncture, the Governor General of Sichuan has now petitioned this board that inasmuch as the criminal's father is presently aged 71 and there is no other adult son in the family, the criminal should accordingly be permitted to stay at home to care for his parents. And finally, at the very end of the case, in the present case, the original report stated that the killing was done unintentionally and accidentally, and thus was different from a senseless act of murderous violence. Therefore, in view of the fact that the case has now reached the status of deferred execution, it is proper that the criminal be permitted to go home and care for his parents. They note beyond that there are still some other, he still gets beaten and some other things, but at least he doesn't get into exile and doesn't get executed, and he gets to stay home and care for his dad. But I just thought it was interesting in part that they go through all of this formal stuff about how you can't be allowed to stay home to care for your aged parent while you're up for execution, but we know that if you're up for execution, it's quite likely you'll end up not getting executed, and once you pass through all of the necessary hoops, now we can decide to mercifully let you stay home. And by the way, we'll feel particularly mercifully, because we really shouldn't have executed him in the first place, because after all, it was only an accident, not an intentional crime. But we had to execute you, because that's what the law said, basically. Anyways, quite weird. Yes? No?
Yeah.
The next one is a, on, starts on page 225, and this is, I thought, was also interesting. The governor of Shantung has memorialized concerning a case in which Kuo Qingxia, acting upon his father's shouted orders, beat and fatally wounded an elder cousin once removed, who belonged to the fourth degree of mourning, and who had unsuccessfully tried to rape the cousin's younger sister-in-law. In his report, the governor has stated that the criminal is the only adult son of aged parents. Coming back to the same case, investigation shows that even in cases involving the beating to death of a senior relative on the paternal side belonging to the fifth degree of mourning, the question of allowing the criminal to stay at home as the sole support of aged parents must wait upon disposition of the case of the Ottoman Assizes. It naturally follows, therefore, that should there be a case involving the beating to death of a senior relative on the paternal side who belonged to the fourth degree of mourning, a petition asking for special treatment for the offender may not be submitted simultaneously with the initial report. All right, so back in the same issue, at what point is it legitimate to ask for let off from this terrible punishment to stay home for your to take care of your aged parents only after you've gotten through the hoops of the capital punishment? Since we know that's the case, even when you happen to kill a relative of the fifth degree, it surely is the case if you kill one of fourth degree. So it's not exactly analogical reasoning, but that's the pattern of using one thing to deduce another, which I thought was also... Note, by the way, that he's doing this beating at his father's instructions, that disobeying his father's command is also a serious crime. Now, it's not entirely clear. It may be that what's going on is that he was supposed to have beaten him but not beaten him to death. We don't know enough about the facts to judge. Let me see whether there were anything else. I think that I have not noticed anything else in that patch. So the next patch, I think, let's go up a little bit, is 239 to 264, is that right? I think it is. Okay, we've got one that's... I wonder why that was... Anyway, 239 to 264. So that's... Got a note here, I've listed all the people, Amy Castello and Brian Phillips. Any comments? Or from anybody else, of course. You don't have to limit yourself to comment. Yes.
I thought the whole section on assault laws was interesting because at first it seemed like it was indicative of the importance of assault, but then when you read through the second case, they had this whole section about how impoverished people were allowed to carry around salt that they made themselves and they could use that to exchange for food. So I wasn't quite sure why...
It's a salt monopoly. The government's got a monopoly, I think, of getting salt from, I think, seawater, though I'm not sure. I don't remember.
Because I think it's salt flats in particular, because they could boil it down themselves.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if it's a monopoly, they seem to have, like, a
very lean... I think what's going on... I didn't reread those particular ones, but I think what's going on is there's a salt monopoly, and then there are some exceptions for poor people, basically, for providing it themselves, but they don't want serious trespass on the monopoly. Other things that struck you in your section?
Another case I thought was interesting is at the beginning when they talk about social status as a big determining factor.
Mm-hmm.
And the second case talked about a young man who had distinguished himself for like amazing military effort. He was in charge, I think it was the defense of the force. And he was still decided that because his father at one point had been essentially a hired servant, they wouldn't promote him or give him an official status.
Yes.
And my first thought is that's really stupid. Because you have someone who clearly draws a lot of respect.
Uh-huh.
And you try to police force and you're going to deny him. You know, I mean, that just seems like you're really making an enemy.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah. But there is this rule that... As I think what's going on is that the father was of the category below ordinary citizen. That is there, that if I remember correctly, at least in the Tang Code, and I'm not sure if it's still the same at this point, you've really got a sort of a three-way course division where the bottom category is slaves, something sort of like serfs, so that's not the term they're using, and then the hired servants. And that his father had been in the hired servant category, and I think that those were the ones that weren't allowed to take the exams, for example, whereas most people, ordinary people, were, and apparently they also weren't allowed to have whatever was military rank, I think is what's
yeah.
going on.
Well, and they even say that, yes, we should, you know, acknowledge the outstanding performance,
yep.
However, how would we be able to give proper distinction to, you know, the sons of... honorable parentage.
Yes.
And it's like, well, you have someone who's shown through their merit that they're very capable, yet you're going to not even give them trust.
Are you going to suggest that if someone showed through his merit that he was more capable than the emperor, that he would be entitled to replace the emperor? What sort of subversive ideas are you propagating here?
Well,
100 blows with a heavy bamboo. Right. Yeah. Yes. There's a lot of, as I say, it's a lot of weird stuff. Yeah.
My guess is that heritable positions or that kind of thing was a way of rewarding of the reward. Because I think these people didn't really see individuals, some kind of family units and lineages. So you incentivize that rather than the individual. And the last tier, the bottom tier, it might have been seen as you go into those if you somehow screwed up, you or your parents or
yeah.
your ancestors.
So it's a negative reward through the family.
Right. So it's like whether you went into debt, so that's why you became a debtor servant, or a lot of slaves came because you were being punished. So in that sense, even if you happen to have a son that was doing really well, you don't want to reward.
You don't want to reward for the father. What pages was it on? Let me look at my copy.
It's page 242.
Page 242.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yes. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. His father had once been the privately employed servant of an official. Mm-hmm. Distinguished himself. Right. No. No. The extreme version of what you're saying is that for the really serious offenses, they not only punish the offender, they basically execute or enslave all of his relatives to varying degrees. And if they're feeling really nice, some of them only go into exile, you know, 3,000 li away. So you certainly get an element of that, of sort of thinking of the family as the unit, which I think shows up in a bunch. Some of the other things we'll see also suggest the family as a unit in other ways. Other things struck you?
I just thought the whole case about the same song girl was kind of funny.
Which page is this?
Towards the end.
You've got photocopies?
259.
259?
Yeah.
Marriage of an official to a sing song girl?
Yeah,
uh huh. Note that this is an imperial clansman. This is a Manchu who's doing it. And he's bought a concubine who is no better than an ordinary sing song prostitute. And he's sentenced to 60 blows to be actually administered.
Yeah.
Huh, that's unusual. So.
I guess it has to do with just the degradation of the
father. Except that he's taking her as a concubine, not as a wife. And it doesn't seem that serious, but apparently, at least for Manchu, it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's another one of the same sort. Other things?
There was another one that has along the same line. Son of a servant tried to buy an official position. And the funny thing that I thought was that people who he bribed also got in trouble for it. like he was given, they were both given 70 blows of the heavy staff because they took bribes from him when they were, you know, signing the papers that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you're getting a good deal of that. That it's clear that they're concerned with disciplining their officials as well as everyone else. One of the ones that struck me in this group, I don't know if any of you people are planning to study tax law, but don't do it in 19th century China, because that's actually the unauthorized assumption of the rural headman's position. This is one in which you have an unsalaried person who's head of, I think, a household of 110, of a community with 110 households or 1,000 households. So he's sort of an official but unsalaried middleman between the people and the government. And somebody, here we are, here's the relevant bit. The governor of Honan has reported a case in which a government military student, Wang Ting Chu, now dismissed, prepared public notices announcing plans for establishing an office for himself, wherein he hoped to fish for profit by handling taxation matters for people and settling their litigations. Isn't that a dreadful activity to engage in? He is accordingly now sentenced to 100 blows of the heavy bamboo and 2 years of penal servitude. By analogy to the statute, which provides 100 blows of the heavy bamboo and transportation reduced to 2 years authorized penal servitude for anyone who falsely terms himself a Pow or Lee head, thereby creating trouble and annoying people. Now, he did not, in fact, falsely claim to be any of those things, and presumably the theory is that he's doing the things those people are supposed to do, and that's enough of an infringement on activity so that we pretend he claimed to be it, and we then sentence him to a fairly heavy, heavy punishment.
So that's actually still punished. When I was studying for the NPRE a while ago, I read a lot about this intense regulation of the area of what they call law firms offering law-related services. You know, something like
in China, modern China.
No.
U.S.
In the U.S. and tax, tax accountancy and tax lawyer. Tax lawyer are very difficult to distinguish. And so, there's all these elaborate procedures you can go through to allow your law firm to offer, your tax law firm to offer accountancy services without, violating ethical rules. I read some decisions in the and the various state bars are pretty hard on lawyers who don't adequately follow those procedures. You won't get beaten with any stick.
Yeah. Well, as you may know, it's illegal for a computer to practice law in Texas. There was some case, I don't know if it still is, but it was a while ago, there was some case involving the question of tax software. And basically the Texas law found that that was, in effect, unlicensed practice of law given. And there have been various cases in the U.S. involving people who are basically giving advice online who are then charged with violations of professional, they're not even charging for it, with violations of professional licensing rules because they're giving advice on one thing or another. If any of you follow the Institute of Justice, which is a public interest law firm that tries to litigate against stuff like that, they're always turning up cases of that sort. Flower arranging. You needed a license and all sorts of elaborate things in order to be allowed to do flower arranging. And oddly enough, the test to determine whether you had passed the requirements was being graded by existing flower arrangers who had some incentive not to allow more competition. Alright, so if nothing else in that section, let me see if I have anything else in that. I guess I do because I got it on page 262. What did I have there? Something interesting. That one was interesting mainly because of the process by which you're deducing punishment. That, as I've mentioned before, you've got a system designed to give a complete mapping from offense to punishment, and it really doesn't, and so you therefore have ways of filling in the blanks. The Department for Honan has examined a case in which Chow Pan Ming, an innkeeper, used money entrusted to him for safekeeping by Chow Tae Chuan with which to buy flour, intending to return the money as soon as he had resold the flour. When Chow Tae Chuan asked to have the money back, however, the defendant was not yet in a position to repay it. At the same time, he was fearful that if word got around that he was making private use of money belonging to the guests at his inn, it would harm his business. He therefore falsely told Chow Tae Chuan that he would have to consult his business partner about repaying the money. This statement put Chow into such a nervous state that he went off and hanged himself. As you may have noticed, depending on what you read, committing suicide is quite common in these cases. This department's investigation indicates that when Chow Pan Ming used the money entrusted to him by Chow Tae Chuan, he definitely intended to repay it, so that his act differs from that of deliberate appropriation of money. Likewise, the fact that his act put Chow Tae Chuan into such a nervous state as to bring him to suicide was entirely unforeseen by the defendant. Sounds like we ought to let him off, right? Under the statute, concerning a person who falsely claims to have lost the property entrusted to him by another, the penalty for so doing is one degree less than that for ordinary theft. Certainly, the defendant's unauthorized use of money entrusted to him by one of his inn visitors, thereby leading to the latter's suicide, was detrimental to the welfare of travelers. Nonetheless, the defendant may be sentenced only by analogy to the substatute concerning a thief whose act of theft induces his victim to commit suicide. The punishment therein provided will be adequate as a public warning. The governor of Hunan, however, has added one degree of punishment to the penal servitude, thereby sentencing the defendant to life exile. Thus, the penalty for inducing a person to commit suicide by selling or using the properties which one has received in trust from him is made even more severe than the penalty for inducing a person to commit suicide by stealing from him. Such a sentence cannot be accepted as fair. Chao Pan Ming's sentence should accordingly be changed to 100 blows of the heavy bamboo and 3 years penal servitude, by analogy to the foregoing substatute concerning suicide occasioned by theft. Furthermore, according to the defendant's testimony, he is the sole adult son of aged parents and therefore under statute eligible for the privilege of remaining at home in order to care for him, for them. The proposal already presented by the governor's report for the defendant's punishment be increased by 1 degree to 100 blows of the heavy bamboo and left life exile, and that he be denied that privilege, need not be deliberated upon further. So if you, what I'm was struck by here is the way they're trying to use related statutes to somehow zero in on what it is or isn't in between, which I thought was sort of neat and interesting. Yeah?
I thought a lot of the cases in this section used analogy, even when they admitted that there was something more on point. So it seemed like it was a convenient way for them to...
Yeah, no, I think that is a plausible interpretation of what's going on, in fact. Right. Do we punish people more severely for an offense that leads to suicide? Do we think we ought to? I'm thinking of a real high-profile case in the last year or two. There was someone who uses, I think, a computer-attached video camera to video his... I don't know if it was his roommate or in a homosexual encounter with somebody else, and the guy who was videoed commits suicide a few days later, and there's all sorts of hue and cry that this guy should get a horrible punishment. There's no evidence actually that was the reason for the suicide as far as I can remember, and I think he ends up getting not as severe a punishment as people were asking for. I'm doing this by memory. I didn't look up the case. Do people remember that case? It struck me precisely because of all these cases that in a sense... It would seem, legally speaking, that normally if you commit suicide, that's your business, that's your decision, not someone else's. And I don't think we go as far as the Chinese case, which pretty clearly treated as basically a version of murder, to do something to somebody, and even the something would be pretty mild, yeah?
Is there a system in Austria that's like this, that is treated as a murder assistance? So if your action leads to the murder of another person, you can...
When you count as your action, that is, in the Chinese case, it looks as though yelling at somebody, if done fiercely enough, and he then commits suicide, counts. Is there any, that is, what do you have to do in order to get convicted of this assistance? You're not just talking about cases where you help him commit suicide, right?
No, no, no. For example, there were cases, for example, that in schools with mobbing other students, or also in companies where other employees has been mobbed.
When you say mobbed, are you talking about anything that would by itself be illegal or just being nasty?
No, just being really like nasty emails or
that kind
making
of,
fun of the
yes.
person.
And he commits suicide, and now what is the legal charge then?
Murder assistance. So
that's interesting. Yeah. So accessory to murder, I guess we would... So is murder assistance like our accessory? Or?
It's even it can be 10 years in prison.
I see.
So it's also
pretty serious. Yeah. Yeah.
I think the crucial difference between our society and theirs is that in East Asian culture, suicide is regarded as an acceptable reaction to a lot of situations. You know, in the U.S., U.S. and Western culture, it's pretty thoroughly demonized as narcissistic or whatever. And I think that given that in that sense, it'd be a lot harder to punish people for suicides of victims of example reminded me of something's getting huge these days, and that's people who commit suicide after they've been bullied.
Yeah.
Like there's this 12-year-old girl who jumped off like some high point in a cement factory or something like that. But anyway, and when they're so closely connected, in the film, the homosexual encounter and such, in that case, it seems like you kind of have to take it into account where you're, doing a disservice. But I think that as a general matter, it's just the connection between the two is too difficult to substantiate, And but when you have, So, you know, for example, in the bullying case, you know, this girl, you know, the girl who killed herself before she did so, she left some sort of message on her you know, Facebook, something like that. So, you know, I mean, presumably, you know, people would have known almost immediately. So, like, in cases like that, you know, maybe, but it's trying to prove it in a criminal way, just, it brings up all kinds of
but note is also taking your case of leaving the message. A different way of looking at it is that there are contexts in which killing yourself is a way of attacking an opponent.
Sure.
If you can get that person blamed. And it's much more true in the Chinese case. And taking it one step further, you can say that one way which you can give power to powerless people is to say, well, you know, if you're really being treated that badly and kill yourself, the guy who treated you badly is going to get into really serious trouble. So that's, you can threaten, you can say, you know, keep this up and I will kill myself, and people have to ease off. It may or may not. But, so you can think, what?
It's a bad incentive.
Maybe, but you can still see that as having a certain kind of logic to it. On the question of committing suicide, yeah?
I just was wondering if it could be related to coercion, almost, if you're bullying or harassing someone so much so that they commit suicide, are you basically coercing them into an act?
Except that in most of these cases, you're not trying to make anything. If you look at the case I've just described, he doesn't want the guy to commit suicide. He's just gotten into trouble because he borrows money and without telling the guy he's borrowing it, and he then can't repay it when it's wanted for, so he tells a cover story. The other guy is afraid his money is lost, and he's so upset by that that he kills himself.
I guess it would depend so much on the facts, but
yep.
In a situation like that, I don't think that it's reasonable that a person would commit suicide over some possibly missing money. But if it's like the bullying case, where it's like someone's like, don't kill yourself because you're, you know, ugly, dumb, whatever,
yep.
Then I would say that should be prosecuted.
Did anybody, one of you must have read the case of the guy who proposed to kill himself for entirely non-negative reasons? One of the Manchu? Yeah, you saw that?
The one where his mentor died
and right. His senior officer who he feels very grateful to dies. And so he says, well, I want to kill myself so that I can follow him into the afterlife and be his servant in the afterlife. But I don't want anybody to get any trouble for this. So I'm going to tell, you know, I'm going to inform my commanding officer or somebody I'm going to kill myself for this reason. And for some reason, his commanding officer did not think that was such a great idea after all. And then the question was, had he done anything wrong? Well, they've decided they're not really going to punish him. But please keep an eye on that idiot, is sort of the bottom line of that particular case. But it was striking again in the idea that somebody would seriously consider apparently killing himself for that kind of reason. I don't know. I, not having lived in that culture, I don't have a clear enough feeling. I mean, one way you can read it is that what's going on is that life is so terrible that who cares? I mean, I don't know if you know the Hitler joke. This is before World War II. An American journalist is interviewing Hitler in the top of a high office building in Berlin, and Hitler is telling him how much my people love me, and he says, "Look, let me prove it to you," and he goes over to one of his guards and he says, "Heil Hitler," and the guard says, "Heil Hitler," and Hitler says, "Heil Hitler, jump out the window." And the guard goes to the window and jumps out it. And the journalist goes to the window and looks down, and, you know, there's this body 10 stories down. "Oh, here, Hitler, this is amazing that your people have such love and loyalty for you. They would do such a thing." "Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let me show you again." Heil Hitler, jump out the window. Guy goes to the window. American journalist grabs him by the window. "Don't you realize it's 10 stories down there? You jump out, you'll lose your life. You call this living?" And jumps. So it's sort of it makes a neat point of the contrast between different explanations of the same behavior. Yeah.
And then more macabre, you know, you could say that if the guard didn't follow Hitler's order, he'd be killed anyway and probably his family too.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. But it's a better line this way.
Yeah.
But the basic point is, so one way of reading these stories is these people are having very marginal lives. Another way is they really believe in their religion and they think that dying isn't all that important, especially if you get to be the servant for the man you respect in the afterlife. Go back to this fact that they make a serious distinction between strangling you and cutting your head off. All right? That you know, you've got judges arguing about is the right punishment for this strangulation or decapitation. And apparently, I gather, the reason they think it matters is that it has post-mortem effects, that decapitation makes your body somehow less suitable for, I don't know, I don't know enough about it to know what they are. I don't know. I don't know what, we could probably find out, but I don't know. All right, the next set, I think, is Daniel and Michelle, if I've got this correct. Daniel F, not the Daniel M who comes in later. I have a surplus of Daniels in this class. Not quite as bad as a surplus of Davids in this faculty, but I assume you all have figured out that if you see a male faculty member and you can't remember his name, you just call him David and your odds are pretty good. We haven't quite taken over yet, but we're working on it. Pretty soon we'll have a majority of the votes and that'll be the end. Anyway, so this is pages 264 to 289. Anyone in that range have any interesting, neat ideas?
I think this I thought was kind of interesting. I don't remember. I didn't think to. I guess I don't know what it was about exactly, but the first one was in the case of the Manchu. And so initially, when I thought it was interesting, was that, so you know how they use analogy to analogize different.
Substations.
That didn't seem very analogous at all, and the book kind of commented on how it wasn't very analogous. But it was a much harsher sentence than what the more analogous citation would have been. And so they gave him like, this really harsh sentence, and then later on, something, I can't remember exactly what it was, but like they had to like change, I guess, like maybe once, like, based on the, like, an appeal.
Which, do you remember which one this?
I don't remember. I want to say it's towards the end of the reading. I can't remember what he did.
The only
one that was about
him. All right, let me see if I've got it.
But I just thought it was interesting the contrast between like the initially very severe sentence and then a much lighter sentence later on. And I was wondering if perhaps there was like some like discrimination against Manchus by like non-Manchu Chinese.
A little unlikely since the Manchus are running things, but.
Well, I mean, but the person who sentenced him wasn't a Manchu.
Yeah.
Maybe.
That is. My memory is that it's a sort of a parallel system where each office is supposed to have a Manchu and a Han official in it, but probably that probably wouldn't be true of the judges.
Perhaps it's like maybe that particular person has something against him, that's why he might be like
yeah.
sentence. And then say there's some kind of like backdoor like
yeah.
dealing going on.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff we don't know along those kinds of lines about what the internal politics of it are. And there are some quite weird cases. Weird in the sense not just that it's a weird legal system, but you can't really figure out what's going on. And they don't tell you enough, basically. The one that I found particularly interesting in here, which is page 276, if you happen to have a photocopy of it, is, let me tell you the whole story, but it's pretty weird. The Governor General of Hubei and Hunan is memorialized concerning Cheng Li, the now dismissed district magistrate of Huang Po Xian, who has been guilty of violating the regulations for the state sacrifices. The Temple of Confucius of the said district has, outside its main gate, an outer enclosure surrounded by a secondary wall through which pass two outer gates. An official coming to the Temple of Confucius to participate in the sacrifices must dismount from his sedan chair when it arrives outside one or the other of these outer gates. The sedan chair is basically it's something being carried by bearers, which you're sitting on, with, I think, curtains around it in this case. On the occasion of the biannual spring and autumn sacrifice to Confucius, Chong Li, as district magistrate, he's an important person, was being carried at dawn in a small sedan chair toward the Confucian temple. The curtain of the chair was closed because of heavy rain. On arriving outside of one of the two above-mentioned gates to the outer enclosure, the two chair-bearers saw that so much rain had accumulated on the ground that there was no place to set down the chair. They therefore wrongly carried Chang Li onward through the gate. Through the lowered curtain, Chang caught a glimpse of what was happening and shouted to the bearers to stop. But so loud was the rain that they failed to hear him as they hurried forward. The magistrate at once got out of the chair in a terrific hurry, but by then it had already been brought as far as the main entrance to the temple. All right, so he's, it's a rainstorm, he's being brought in, he's supposed to get out of the sedan chair before he enters the temple, but his bearers, being crude, unlettered people, and who don't want to dump him in a puddle, bring him in through, and he doesn't stop them in time. The district director of schools and others were inside the temple at the time arranging the sacrificial offerings. However, a first-degree licentiate was present to watch the ceremony and happened to glimpse the incident. He reported it to the director of schools. Subsequently, two other persons who had also witnessed it, Hu Chi Chuan and Ye Mei Kui, presented written charges which judicial examination has failed to approve. All right, so think about this. What does he do? He doesn't get out of the sedan chair in time, and three different people report him to the authorities for it.
Not popular.
What?
Not popular.
I don't think that's what's going on. The Board of Punishments finds that Chang Li was lacking in respect when he participated in the sacrifice of the Temple of Confucius. His failure to dismount from the chair in time, though occasioned by the great accumulation of rainwater on the ground and the error of the chair bearers, nevertheless constitutes a violation of the established regulations. Accordingly, he should be sentenced to 100 blows with a heavy bamboo under the statute on violation of imperial decrees. Because he has already been dismissed from his position, this sentence requires no further deliberation. The point being that if he was still a magistrate, then he's not supposed to be beaten. I think he then gets to compound it for money or something. As to the two chair bearers, they are to receive the heavier punishment provided under the statute on doing what ought not to be done, namely heavy bambooing and wearing the kang for 1 month. The kang is a sort of a very clumsy yoke that you have on you, such that you can't readily reach your face and such with your hands, and wearing that is a humiliating punishment, presumably a fairly unpleasant one as well. It has been found that Hu Chi Chuan, one of the two persons who presented written charges against the magistrate, although a purchaser of official rank and belonging to the category of unclassed officials, was yet improperly wearing the golden button of the seventh rank. His case will receive separate consideration. As for the other person, who also brought written charges against the magistrate, because these charges have been proved to be correct, there is no need to deliberate further concerning him. So they not only are they severely punishing a fairly high official for something that's not his fault, but that's a violation of the rules, they are also quite suspicious of everybody who reported him and want to at least look at them and see if they've done anything wrong as well. So I think this fits my idea that they want people to stay out of the legal system if possible, and if, how do they do it when they get in the legal system, they make it really unpleasant. So I don't know. I mean, I'm wondering if what's going on is that if somebody saw him and didn't report him and someone else reported him, they'd really get in trouble. And that's why everybody feels obliged to report him. It could be your explanation as an alternative. They don't like him for some reason. But other comments? No. Anyway, that's one of the cases that struck me just because it seems to our feelings so grossly disproportionate for something that wasn't really his fault. You know?
It kind of reminds me of, back in criminal law, one of the theories for why you punish people, even if they're guilty and they never do anything, is so that they can have the dignity of being able to feel like they paid for the crime. And in this case, I'm wondering, so there's a high emphasis on ritual propriety. By, even though it's not really anyone's fault, no one was intending to do it, by drinking something that was, they might have seen as sacred. They want to be able to do something so that they can have that dignity of paying back what they've transgressed against. So maybe it's something like that. I'm wondering.
Maybe, though we aren't told that he himself confessed the crime, which you might expect to be the thing to do if that was what was going on. Mm-hmm. But to what extent... Yep.
Oh, actually, that reminds me of Stone Troopers by Robert Heinlein.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, at least not the movie, is lots of fun, but crap. In the book, Rico mentions that there are infractions that would get like a private assigned to, you know, kitchen duty or solitary confinement or something like that, you know, but that would get his lieutenant hung, you know, and because that's when, because, you know, in this case, if, you know, the magistrate really wanted to avoid this, he would have educated his chair bearers about, you know, so, you know, like, no matter what, don't let me go through. I mean, you know, I mean, Never, you know, so, yep. I mean, you know, obviously it'd be hard to go through all the possible scenarios, but, you know.
Yep.
And, like, you know, in that case, you know, this is something that's common in military justice, is that the fault of a subordinate is the fault of the commanding officer.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. To what extent does our law punish people for things that aren't their fault?
Depends. Well, like strict liability crimes.
That is, it's clear, I think, the tort law does. But we like to pretend that it's not a punishment, that it's a compensation to the victim.
We have crimes that are strict liability, too. So, like, if my friend throws an empty beer can in the back of my car, and I get pulled over, I'm automatically, you know, tapped for that, even though I didn't know about it. I mean, it's just...
That's interesting. So strict liability would be the case. I was thinking of a slightly subtler distinction, which is the fact that we have very different punishments for murder and for attempted murder. Even though being a bad shot is not a moral virtue. And yet it would seem as though in terms of desert they're equally bad, and yet we treat them quite differently. And this gets into an issue that philosophers call the problem of moral luck. Have I discussed that in this class before? Because it's an interesting issue. That imagine that you discovered that your neighbor had been a camp guard in Nazi Germany. You would feel very badly about him. Suppose somebody gave you evidence that most people brought to adulthood in, say, the 1930s in Nazi Germany and offered the job of a concentration camp guard would have accepted it. Do you therefore say, well, why should I feel any worse about this neighbor of mine who actually did it than about all the other billions of people who would have done it if only they had happened to be born in that environment? That's the problem of moral luck. All right, makes sense? And yet we do feel differently about it. Or to take a different example that I sometimes offer, you're driving at night, a small child steps out into the road, you swerve, and you barely miss him. Or somebody, imagine, it doesn't have to be you, it's imagine with somebody else. The moral implications of that and barely hitting him are enormously different, even though the difference might be, you know, 6 inches. And how far you swerved, and we don't really think of, you know, is your reaction time 0.3 seconds or 0.4 seconds, doesn't seem like a moral issue. So there are a fair number of things of that sort. I originally got into it in a sort of somewhat odd context of a death penalty question, which was whether it was legitimate in the death penalty hearing to have testimony about the life of the victim. And thus about how much damage, as it were, the murderer had done. And in a sense, I would argue at least that if the murderer knew the facts, then it makes sense that you want to deter killing, in this case, a young mother with two small children, more than you want to deter killing of a 90-year-old man who's going to drop dead in another year anyway. Our law doesn't say that, but it seems to me to make some sense. But what if you didn't know, and that then gets you into moral luck? And I concluded that the best discussion I could find of moral luck was in the first book written by Adam Smith, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, not as well known as The Wealth of Nations, which devotes several chapters to what I thought was quite a neat discussion. But it's enough of a digression, and we've got too much to talk about, so you'll have to find another time. We've got a few minutes for you, and I'll tell you the whole story, which is a neat story. But anyway, let's go on. And... is there anything else in my list for that chunk? No. So the next chunk is 297 to... It's 289 to 315. And the question is, do any of those people have things that struck them? Nobody at all. Let's see, who are those people? It's Brittany and Nabila. Let me mention one thing in there that I thought was sort of weird. And this was page 313. And I will show you in a minute why it's weird. The governor of Shantung has submitted a memorial on a case concerning Chang Quang, who was an accomplice of Chang Lo San in the premeditated homicide of a little boy. In the present case, Chang Lo San resented being reviled by Chang Xineng and his wife and resolved to murder their 4-year-old son. He informed Chang Quang, who, being on bad terms with another man, Wang Fengxiang, told Chang Losun that if he murdered the boy, he should take the corpse to Wang's courtyard so as to make trouble for Wang. All right, I was discussing before the idea of getting people entangled in the law as a way of getting at them, and this is a way that doesn't involve an anonymous accusation, but turned out to be even more dangerous. Chang Losun accordingly seized an opportunity to murder the child, following which Chang Kuang appeared on the scene to see what had happened. Chang Losun told Chang Kuang to go ahead of him to Wang's courtyard so as to keep an eye out for people, while he himself would follow with the corpse. Having done this and left the corpse in the courtyard, the two men separated, but shortly afterward were apprehended. It doesn't tell us how they caught him, but it doesn't matter. And it then runs through the details of the circumstance. The governor of Shantung has accordingly sentenced Chang Kuang to penal servitude under the above-named statute on a person who, though an accomplice in a case of premeditated homicide, is not himself actually present at the killing. The governor has also announced the decease of the offender through illness, so that there is no need to deliberate the case further. We find that the punishment fits the circumstances and that it is appropriate to ask for a confirmatory reply. Or in other words, the whole procedure of sending up to the higher authority to confirm the verdict of the lower authority is going through despite the fact that the person they're punishing is dead. Would that happen in our system? Hard to believe that it would it?
No, I don't.
Maybe as an appeals court case?
Pretty sure once
you're sentenced to prison and your attorney appeals and you have a heart attack, can the appeal be continued or not?
Well, if there's novel or controversial questions of law, then we're here just to weigh in on those issues.
But
you'd
think, yeah, I guess. I don't know. It just struck me as weird, and one of the things I always ask when something is weird in a foreign system is, does it really happen with us too?
If there's fines, though, the decedent's escape
might be affected. That could be possible. Yeah, but that's not, I think, what's going on here. Yes, right. Let me go on. The next one, I think, says Robert Caetano and Vladimir Rudoy, who is right there. So you have there you are. You have 315 to 341. Did you? Yes. What did you find interesting?
Yeah, I thought the laws regarding if there was some kind of organized rape in California, that if the organizer himself dies either in prison or during the fray, then everybody else gets a lesser punishment.
And what's going on, at least they think, is this sort of life for a life balance of nature theory. That this is a case, if I remember correctly, I remember it was the same one. I'm pretty sure there's one of these where the person who dies, I think, is not the most guilty of the group of people who were sentenced. They're all sentenced to some kind of capital punishment, though I think it's probably after the assizes, which is why they're still alive at this point. And then one of them happens to die. And at that point, they don't have to execute anybody because somebody's life has already been paid, so they can scale it one step down to, I think, probably life exile is my guess of what's going on. Does that sound right? Yeah. Anything else that you noticed in the? No. All righty. Let me see if I noticed something else in this group. Ah, yes. Page 317 to 318, and this is a father who murders his son in order to continue an adulterous affair, which doesn't sound like a very admirable behavior. Wu Tawen committed adultery with the wife of Cha Chuan Kui. Cha tolerated the situation for the sake of money he was receiving from Wu. Wu's second son, Wu Yanhua, however, refused to keep silent and spread the news. On hearing about it, Wu's landlord ordered Wu to move from his premises. Wu accordingly moved to another rented house, taking with him his son and his son's wife, as well as Cha Chuan Kui and his wife. In the new house, however, Wu's son and Cha Chuan Kui continued to quarrel frequently, until Cha decided that he and his wife would have to move elsewhere. Wu, as a result, became fearful that his affair with Mrs. Cha would come to an end. He therefore resolved to kill his son, so that he might continue to keep the Cha couple in his house. Accordingly, Wu schemed with Cha to lure the son to a secluded place, where Wu seized his son by the queue, cut his throat, and killed him. All right, so what do you think is an appropriate penalty for the father who, in order to protect his adulterous affair, lures his son to a deserted place and cuts his throat?
Parents have a lot of latitude with their kids in China, I know, so I think that's probably will get up there to stop my wrist.
How about the person who helped him do it?
Probably capital, but I'm not sure.
Does that depend on whether, oh, no, never mind. They give themselves in, but it's permanent injury, and it doesn't matter.
Yes, correct.
So I would think that it would be decapitation immediately.
For which one?
For the principal, or the father. I don't know,
that's just my guess. Yeah. No, he's got basically right. We find it extremely cruel of Wu Tawen to have killed his son, sure was, with premeditation, because of lustful desire for an adulterous relationship. The Hubei Provincial Court has already sentenced him to penal servitude under the statute on parents who intentionally kill a son. Just a minute. And as for Cha Chuan Kuei, it has been ascertained that though he was a party to the plan for the killing, he did not himself play a physical role in the killing. Hence, the associate governor Hupei has sentenced him under the statute on premeditated homicide to life exile as an accomplice but not as a physical participant in the homicide. So in other words, the accessory gets a lower penalty than the murderer because the murderer is the father and therefore has a partial right to kill his son, not enough to get him off entirely.
So the accessory's punishment has to be based on the father's punishment?
No, the accessory's punishment is based on the fact that he was an accessory to a murder. And that gets him something serious. The father gets 60 blows and 1 year of penal servitude, which is sort of a middle level. I mean, it's not a slap on the wrist, literally, but as opposed to the killing outside of the family. And there's another one of these cases in the same group, which is a mother who, where if a mother kills her child to conceal her adultery, she gets strangulation after the assizes. Whereas she does it, if she kills a stepchild, she gets decapitation after the assizes, which may sound like a small difference to us, but killing the stepchild is a more serious offense than killing the child. And I think, again, what's going on is that she has a sort of a very partial ownership of the child, as it were, and therefore some part.
But
yep.
The stepchild, the child's father, would, by law, would have a much stronger right, and she has a much weaker right, I suppose.
I don't know whether the stepchild is her husband's, or I guess probably. I guess so. One of the rules that shows up in some of these, incidentally, is that if you have multiple offenses, unlike our system, only the most serious one counts. They aren't stacking punishments, which is sort of interesting. On the other hand, there are some cases where multiple offenses are a different offense. So that in particular, killing two members of the same family is a much more serious offense than killing one person, which seems, or killing two unrelated people for that matter, which seems odd to us.
Well, generally, I mean, family is a really important,
yes,
unit. Even in government, so if you exterminate your family is a big deal.
Yes. Uh-huh. All right. I think 342 to 368, if I'm not losing track of things, is our next category. Oh, no, I've got some. Oh, no, I already got that. We already did that one, yes. The next one is Clayton and Munira. Or anybody else who happened to notice anything interesting in that section? Do we have anybody? We don't have anybody. What did I see in that section? This was sort of interesting. A couple of related things. This is page 342. And this is the question of accidental killing. The governor of Fujian has reported a case in which Wu Qili set off fireworks, thus causing fire resulting in the deaths of four persons. The occasion was one on which Wu had gone to the mountains to offer sacrifices at the tombs of his ancestors. The charred remnants of the fireworks set fire to a thicket, and four people died as a result. This board finds that what happened was neither foreseeable nor avoidable. From this, it follows that the sentence should be based upon the statute on killing by accident, under which redemption by fine is permitted. In cases of multiple accidental killings, however, the relevant substatute states that the amount of redemption money depends upon the number of persons killed. Yet in the present case, the governor has ordered Wu Chi Li merely to pay a single sum of 12.42 ounces of silver, which is a mistake. He should instead order Wu to pay four times this amount. The total will be divided equally among the families of the four victims. And if I've got it right, I believe that this is a case where he's paying redemption instead of receiving the much more serious punishment that he would have received for deliberate killing. I'm not sure that's right, but I think it is. Yeah?
Is there any legal relevance to the fact that, when he saw the fireworks, he was honoring his ancestors?
Doesn't at least say that it is. But what I thought was more interesting, the question is, how much is 12.42 ounces? This is a question, whenever you see these things, you'd like to get some measure. When I did my Icelandic stuff, what I did was that one of the forms of money they used was wool cloth. And I knew somebody who had done spinning and weaving with Icelandic technology for the fun of it, so to speak. So I got her to estimate how many hours of labor it took to produce a certain amount of wool cloth as some measure of how valuable it was. Here, we've got a figure in one of the cases that 0.855 ounces a day were seen as the proper wage for a worker on a government construction project. So a little less than an ounce a day is a worker of not a particularly high-skilled labor. So in other words, the punishment for killing somebody turned into money is about 2 weeks' pay, which seems sort of trivial to us. And maybe to them as well. So it sort of looks as though one way in which they get to distinguish more and less serious versions of the same crime, as it were, is by whether they allow redemption. Yeah?
It seems hard to look at how much hours of labor, because if they can't really save much for those days of labor, it's kind of a lot. It could mean you start to death.
It could. It could. Though, of course, it's the same for everybody. We get to a case later where it's a physician who probably is not at starvation level. Yeah.
That could be a false equivalence, though, because I know that in a lot of, for example, the Confederate States, when they had really high inflation, gold dollars, one gold dollar would be worth, thousands of Confederate dollars. They're technically denominated.
But these are all ounces of silver.
Well, I know, but see, the thing is that the Chinese government ran paper money and silver alongside each other, and silver, I know, was really limited, so they probably had to pay, for reasons of governance, they had to pay their own people in silver, but for the majority of people, that could be a lot more money.
I just don't know enough about it to know whether they're making, as there certainly have been systems where you have different monies with the same name, but they usually, in the language, distinguish between what they are. Florins of account versus florins of gold in gold, for instance. Let me see. This is the other 12.42, which does seem pretty standard. 352. And this is, again, an interesting one. The governor of Anhui has reported on a case previously appealed to Peking by Sui Chuan Yan concerning a medical practitioner, Ye Chuan Kuang, who had treated Shui's son with acupuncture so that the latter died. This board finds the case to be one in which Sui Chuan Yan's son had been suffering from an internal congestion. Ye Chuan Kuang, on finding the patient's pulse to be faint, diagnosed this to be cholera, the treatment for which, according to medical writings, is acupuncture. To Shui's objection that the day was an unlucky one, and therefore unpropitious for acupuncture, Ye replied that if the illness were allowed to continue, it might well prove incurable. He accordingly performed acupuncture on the hands and feet of the patient, gave him medicine, and administered drops of ginger juice into his eyes, the result being that the patient perspired profusely until he passed away. Malpractice, right?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Some time ago, Shui came to Peking to present an accusation, which was then transmitted to Anhui for handling. After due consideration, so he was willing to accuse somebody despite all the risk of doing this, but what happens? After due consideration, the provincial court, acting under the statute on doctors who kill their patients, sentenced Ye Chuan Kuang to strangulation, this to be commuted to monetary redemption. Monetary redemption, they mentioned in the notes, is 12.42 ounces of silver. As for Shui Chuan Yan himself, the provincial court likewise, this is the guy who complained, sentenced him to bambooing, under the statute, I'm presenting an accusation which proves to be false. Of course, his accusation wasn't false, but that's a detail. It then submitted a report to the Board of Punishment so as to conclude the case. This statute, this is the notes, this statute provides 100 blows of the heavy bamboo for an accusation which, though presented in good faith, proves to be false. However, it also limits this punishment to persons who actually bring their accusation before the emperor himself. This limiting clause, based on a tradition which by Qing times had become anachronistic, was ignored by many officials who used the statute as a convenient device for disposing of important practitioners. And there's a much later case where finally the higher-ups sort of catch on to this and start complaining that you aren't supposed to bamboo people just for complaining unless they bother the emperor, which is what the statute tells you to do. But presumably, I'm assuming what's going on is that they're claiming that his accusation against the doctor overstated the case, and that's why he's getting a punishment of 100 blows while the doctor is having to pay 12 ounces. Yeah?
Another thing that would support your point about wanting to keep people out of the legal system is that the case's language implies that the petitioner had to go all the way to Beijing to file, so he couldn't file his claim with the local court. He had to
yes.
To the, so, yeah, that's a huge
thereafter, however, Shui again came to Peking and submitted an accusation on the grounds that Ye's sentence did not pay for his offense, whereas Shui himself had been unfairly subjected to bambooing. This appeal was once more transmitted to the provincial court, which after examination has now reaffirmed its original decision. And it then goes on to basically approve of the original things, but at least they're not punishing him again for his second complaint. But it does suggest that complaining to the authorities may not always be a really clever idea. Let's see. The next set is 368 to 394. Do either of the people who did that one have cases? That's Nana and Daniel. If they remember their cases, anybody here? If not here, no comments. Different Daniel. Got too many Daniels around here. It gets confusing. Three Daniels? Two Daniels? Not sure. Three Daniels. No wonder we can't keep track of anything. Let me see what else I noticed in here. Yes, and the question again of parents. 389 to 391, which is a father who intentionally and unreasonably kills a son. The military government, this is not unreasonable, perhaps a little bit of an overreaction. The military government of Kirin has reported a case in which Wang Qi, a father, killed his son by burying him alive. This department finds, according to statute, that if parents or grandparents unreasonably beat and thus kill a son or grandson who has violated their commands, the penalty for so doing is 100 blows of the heavy bamboo. If the killing is intentional, the penalty becomes 60 blows and 1 year's penal servitude. Another statute states that if parents or grandparents beat and thus kill a son or grandson by whom they have been assaulted or reviled, they are to incur no penalty at all. Concerning the second statute, the commentary explains that the son or grandson who assaults or reviles a parent or grandparent has thereby already committed a capital crime, which is why the parent is to incur no penalty. So this keeps on going. In the present case, the older son of Wang Qi had wanted to borrow money from the younger son, and when he refused, the older son became so enraged that he chased the younger son with a knife. The father, on hearing this, dragged the older son home, tied his hands with a rope, and upbraided him. The older son reviled his father in turn, which so enraged the father that he buried his son alive. Thus, although the killing was done intentionally, it was the killing of a son who had committed a capital crime by reviling his father. Such a killing is therefore not an intentional killing because this term is used to designate the killing of a son who has not been disobedient. Likewise, since the son had reviled his father, there is a distinction between such killing and what is termed unreasonably beating and killing a disobedient son. The military government of Korea has been unjust, therefore, in sentencing Wan Chi to beating under the statute covering the latter offense, and his sentence should be changed to no punishment at all in order to accord with the meaning of the law. As for the younger brother, he was coerced by his father to help bury alive his older brother. At present, he is a fugitive. When apprehended, however, and brought to trial, if the facts prove to be as they have been reported, it will be permissible to accompany his sentence with a petition for clemency. Yeah?
So now, let's say that the father, having been sentenced to punishment by the local court, had received his punishment.
I don't think he... Oh.
So if he'd been beaten over, then it would have been...
That's interesting, because the beating is the punishment that doesn't require being appealed. Doesn't require approval by higher authority, so it could have happened. I don't know. I don't know what the consequences are for unjust punishment. It's an interesting question. All right, the next one, we've got Daniel, another Daniel, and we've got Alfred. So these are pages 394 and 420, I think. That looks right. Did you see something interesting?
Yeah, it was about where a junior reports an elder, and I have a hypothesis. Oh, let me describe what it is. So it's basically the punishment is generally the same. So, the standard punishment
for reporting a member of your family for a crime.
Right, that's elder, but if the crime that the elder would have been punished. Is higher, then the junior also gets that high punishment as well. That's up to a certain extent.
Do you remember what what page the case is on?
No.
So I can check it. No. Yeah?
I also text something. It was around the 410, I guess. It was when the parents are committing suicide because it's clear that the entrepreneurial project is from the son is failing. Then the son makes itself guilty of the offense.
Yes, right. I think, if I remember correctly, it's not only. Where was it? I thought there was one. Where was it? Right. No, I think your case is only if it's a false accusation. If I've got it right from my notes here, if the accusation is correct, it's 100 blows. And if it's false, he gets the punishment for the crime plus 3 degrees.
No, I'm pretty sure that it's even if it's a true accusation. But
what I'm looking about is starts at page 405, accusations by junior against senior relatives. Is that it?
Mm-hmm. I don't know the exact page number.
All right.
But I'm pretty sure, and I was shocked.
What it says here is the punishment for a junior relative accusing a second degree senior relative is 100 blows of the heavy bamboo. This is the basic punishment, irrespective of whether the charge is true or false. Suppose, however, that the accusation is a false one, and that the offense it imputes to the senior relative calls for a punishment greater than 100 blows, let us say 1 year's penal servitude. Then the junior relative making the accusation will receive the same 1 year punishment plus a further increment of 3 degrees. So it sounds as though it's a fixed punishment when it's a true punishment for you when it's a true accusation, but if it's a false accusation of something more serious than the punishment for a true accusation, you get that plus 3.
When
there's a non-relative, when you accuse someone that is a non-relative
to you,
mm-hmm.
and it's a false accusation, accusation,
it's required the same punishment as the crime itself.
Is that right? That may be correct.
There's,
let me see. Yeah?
So, one thing I was wondering about was contributory negligence and stuff like that. So, uh-huh. You know, like, in some cases, you know, someone is, like a defendant who's partially guilty, let's say, and partially innocent. Let's say the, a junior relative, brings a charge against a senior, and that happens to be the case. They're half guilty and half not. Would the junior sibling still get that punishment plus 3 degrees?
I don't know. But here is the part that I really had to read you just for your own safety. Imperial Edict received August 17th, 1820 by the Department for Chi Li of the Board of Punishments. This may not be the date you want to set your time machine for. The censor Chu Hung is extremely correct in what he says in his memorial about the need to check abuses of unbridled litigation and so extinguish vicious habits. The multiplication of lawsuits among the people brings much harm to rural communities. And the machinations of the litigation tricksters, that's you folks, are what produce all the inconsequential verbiage going helter-skelter into these accusations. Isn't this wonderful? These rascally fellows entrap people for the sake of profit. They fabricate empty words and heap up false charges. At their bidding, plaintiffs are induced to bring up stupid nonsense in their accusation, whose empty falsity, when exposed at the trial, brings blame upon the plaintiffs themselves while the litigation tricksters stand to one side. The victims of these false accusations, once they have been dragged in, remain entrapped and their livelihood is gone. Even should they have the luck to be completely exonerated, notice only luck that gets you exonerated when you're merely innocent, as a result of the trial, their families will by then have become ruined. No one knows how many lives have thus been damaged or brought to an end at the same time that the tricksters, you people, look on from the side and chirp their satisfaction. All these devilish doings certainly deserve our bitter detestation. And you thought lawyers were unpopular here. In all yamens, government offices, in Chile where cases are heard, let it now be ordered that whenever magistrates encounter a false tramped-up accusation, they must investigate to find out who has instigated the accusation, who has guided it, who has planned it, who has publicized it. As soon as all this has been determined, the person responsible must be immediately arrested, severely punished, and not allowed to escape. In addition, the local officials, whenever accepting any legal petition, should always find out first whether the petitioner himself actually composed and wrote it. Either they may compare the document with the petitioner's own handwriting, or they may take a section of it and ask him to expound its meaning. If the petitioner is unable to expound the section, they must press him for the name of the litigation specialist who prepared the petition and by no means allow the petitioner to claim that it was written for him by some itinerant fortune teller or medicine peddler. As soon as the litigation specialist has been arrested and brought to account, all the circumstances of how he planned and perpetrated the false accusation must be strictly investigated. Heavy punishments should always go to him, whereas the person tricked by him into presenting the accusation may be shown leniency. Let the investigation thus be probing and painstaking, and then these rascally fellows will go into hiding. The multitude of lawsuits will diminish daily, and decent, respectable people will gain security. Now, if that isn't sufficient rounds for all of you to go straight, abandon your plans to be litigation tricksters, I don't know what could be.
Actually, that brings up a question I had. So, I imagine the percentage of people that you write was like probably 1 to 3% maybe. If you were a con person with a complaint, do you have like a scribe write that for you?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. You'd have a litigation trickster write it up.
Would the scribe have to worry about being accused of being a litigation trickster?
Yeah, I don't know what arrangements they have. I know that in Kim by Kipling, it's pretty clear that there are sitting in India in the late 19th century people who were in the business of being scribes and writing things for people. But I don't know what the situation is in China at this time. Anyway, it's fun stuff. Hopefully I've given some of you a taste for primary sources.
Are we going to be covering this?
Not sure. I will look at how much more I have to do. Because I think we only have one more.